sounds low-key and down-home, but in music circles, Les Paul was a mover and a shaker, a combination of musician and inventor, whose influence on the music industry is strong to this day. What combination of talents enabled the Waukesha Wizard, as he was called, to change the course of music? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did growing up in Wisconsin in the 1920s and 30s shape Les Paul to a major force in 20th century music? What lasting effects did he have on country music, jazz, and rock and roll? And how did he use the new medium, radio, to his advantage? Our guest is Bob Jacobson, the author of Les Paul, Guitar Wizard, published in 2012 by the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press as part of their Badger Biography series.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
If you had to describe Les Paul to someone who had never heard of him, in just a sentence or two, what would you say?
I think it's fair to say that Les Paul had as much to do with making popular music as we know it today possible as probably anyone else in history, both through his musical innovations and his inventions. He was a real giant, and I think if you ask any serious electric guitar player about Les Paul, they will start to gush.
Well, let's take him to Waukesha and get him born.
Sure.
And what was significant about his childhood that helped to set the stage for what he would become?
Well, I think the most important thing about his childhood in terms of how it contributed to what he would accomplish was the relationship he had with his mother. Les was born in 1915, and his parents split up when he was quite young, so he and his brother were raised primarily by their mother. And she was extremely supportive of everything that he did. From a very, very early age, he liked to take apart machines that made sounds, such as her phonograph and her player piano, and she let him do this.
He was okay at putting them back together, too?
Fortunately, he was. I think if he hadn't been, maybe she would have stopped him a little sooner. But she was always encouraging him to do that kind of exploration. And when, by age 15, he had his first opportunity to leave home and go on tour for the summer with a professional band, she did not stand in his way. And I think that was really one of the important factors in his kind of can-do attitude that allowed him to overcome obstacles throughout his career.
How did he do in school?
There's not too much information about that I've seen. But he didn't end up finishing school. He actually left home for good to become a full-time professional musician at age 17. So he never finished high school. Obviously, he had all of the science and engineering education he needed long before that.
And Les Paul wasn't the name he was born with.
No, he was not. He was born Lester Polsfuss, a nice German name. And he actually went through a couple of name changes before he arrived at Les Paul later in his career. When he first started playing music professionally at about age 13, he would go by the name Red Hot Red because he had red hair. And then later, after he had moved to St. Louis and Chicago to play kind of cornball hillbilly music, he went by Rhubarb Red. And it really wasn't until he got interested in jazz and wanted to become a jazz dude that he started going by Les Paul.
So he started out just playing regular acoustic guitar, and the kind of the inventing was on the side for a little while?
Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, he did initially start off, like everybody at that time, on the acoustic guitar. But it was when he was a real young performer, around 13 years old or so, and was starting to play at outdoor parties and in parking lots of restaurants and things, he very early on saw the need to make the guitar louder. You just can't hear it a very long distance or over other louder instruments. So he was, from a very early age, experimenting with ways to make it louder. One early thing he did was he took the needle and tone arm from his mother's record player and stuck that to the bridge of his guitar and then wired that to the phonograph speaker. And voila, you have an early electric guitar.
Kind of a live phonograph.
Didn't sound particularly good, but he basically spent the next 20 years of his life trying to improve on that and make it work better.
Where do you get the first recordings of his music?
You know, I am not aware of where any recordings of his really early stuff are when he was playing with a guy named Sonny Joe Wolverton, and they had a group first in St. Louis and later in Chicago called the Ozark Apple Knockers. They may exist somewhere. I'm not aware of them. The first real recordings he made were as a backup musician while he was kind of moonlighting as a jazz player at night while in Chicago. But the earliest ones that I've actually listened to were after he had moved to New York, and that would have been latest 1930s, 1940 or so. And he would have been playing with Fred Waring's orchestra, Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians.
Sure,
in New
big,
York.
Yes, a big name at the time, Fred Waring. You wouldn't necessarily say discovered Les Paul, but really gave him a big break.
He gave him a very big break. And, you know, the story goes that Les had his trio in Chicago. It was Les Paul. It was Jimmy Atkins, who was the older brother of Chet Atkins, and a guy named Ernie Newton on bass. And Les said, hey, let's go to New York. And he lied to them. He told them that he was buddies with one of the biggest band leaders at the time, Paul Whiteman, and said, yeah, I'll get us in with Paul Whiteman, no problem. It's a total lie. So he drags him to New York. And his plan was to essentially ambush Paul Whiteman and show him how great they were, and he would hire them. Didn't quite work out, but while Paul Whiteman was ignoring them, they managed to ambush Fred Waring, and Fred noticed right away these guys were really good and signed him up.
Fred was an inventor, too, invented the Waring blender.
I don't know if he actually invented it, but that is the same Waring that goes on all those kitchen appliances. I think maybe he just bankrolled the company, but I'm not sure.
Kind of a George Foreman thing.
could be.
And Les Paul also invented a way to hold a harmonica, too, right?
He did, and I don't know if he was the first person to do that, because it seems kind of obvious. He wanted to play the harmonica and play the guitar at the same time, so he took a coat hanger and bent it in such a way that he could stick the harmonica in it and play it while he was playing the guitar.
He could flip it, too.
That's what he said. He said that he rigged it up in such a way that he could flip it over with his chin so he could play it from either side. And I have a hard time envisioning quite how that worked.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure that one out.
But, you know, how much different is that from, you know, folkies today have a similar thing. They don't make it out of a coat hanger. They probably buy them ready-made
now. Sure, Bob Dylan.
It's probably not all that different from what Les was using.
Is there a song we can listen to that gives us a sense of his music?
Yeah, the earliest recording that I like is from his days with Fred Waring when he was in New York. And this song is called Lazy River, and this was recorded in 1940.
Les Paul Trio, two guitars and a bass with the voice of Jimmy Atkins, and the song Lazy River.
In love, up a lazy river, how happy we can be, up a lazy river with me. Up above, everyone's in love. Up a lazy river, how happy we could be. Up a lazy river with me.
Django Reinhardt an influence there? I mean, he was certainly well known in Europe, I guess, at this point. He seemed to catch on a little bit in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Les and Django became friends in the couple of years right before that. And I know that Les was very influenced by Django. He had never heard anybody play like that before. And he was definitely paying attention to Django's licks as he developed his style as a jazz player.
And as we're listening to that Lazy River song, what in that sound would you say Les Paul was responsible for inventing?
Well, by that time, he was using an electric guitar most of the time. He had been experimenting for years with using different types of pickups and connecting them in different ways and putting them in different places on the guitar. And so by that point, he was coming close to what was his big breakthrough just a year later in 1941, which was his invention of the log, which was his name for his first really successful electric guitar. And the log was basically a big slab of pine with a fretboard attached to it and pickups on it. And then he attached the curvy parts just so that it would still look like a guitar. but they were just for show. And he tried to get the Gibson Company to market the log, but they just scoffed. They didn't think anybody would buy that. So he continued to work with another company, Epiphone, which was later bought by Gibson and is now part of the same company, on a series of guitars that came after the log that he called his clunkers. And so he just kind of went through generation after generation of them for the next decade until Gibson finally decided to put a Les Paul guitar on the market, which they kind of had to do because by then a bunch of other electric guitar inventors like Leo Fender and Adolf Rickenbacker had come out with pretty good solid body electric guitars too, and the Gibson didn't want to be left behind. So they finally said, okay, Les, we're going to put your guitar out.
So where was the market at this point? I mean, you've mentioned, country, the Apple Knockers, earlier
yeah.
on. You mentioned jazz in New York, and I guess we haven't exactly used the word pop at this point, but there was obviously a big market for that. And Les Paul seems to have played all three of them at least. And so where is he going to be gravitating toward? Is it going to be jazz in the 40s?
Well, you can really kind of trace this from his arrival in Chicago after doing that hillbilly music in St. Louis and Springfield, Missouri for a while with Sonny Joe Wolverton, shows up in Chicago where all of a sudden he's exposed to all this amazing groundbreaking jazz of all these greats, and he starts hitting the nightclubs and jamming with them. So at that point he's like, yeah, I want to be a jazz guy. But what keeps happening over and over during that period is he can't make any money doing it. So to make a living, he has to keep falling back to his rhubarb red character and keeps reviving the hokey hillbilly shtick. And even years later, after he had had some success playing, you could call it jazz or pop or whatever it was he was doing with big bands in New York, at the same time, he was playing jazz at night in the clubs with some of New York's hottest musicians. But then even a few years later, after he had moved to Los Angeles, his whole act that ended up being his most prolific era with Mary Ford, who he ended up marrying, was more kind of country, simpler music. It wasn't really jazz. And I think you could probably just say the reason is that there simply was not as much of a market and not as much money to be made playing real jazz.
How savvy was he when it came to radio?
Very savvy. He was an early innovator in some ways. When Les and Mary had their own radio show in the 50s, after they had released a couple of hit records, they ended up setting up their own broadcast studio out of their home. So they didn't even have to go anywhere. They could just record at their pre-record at their leisure at home and send it into the studio and do it that way.
What about World War II? Because we, the last song we heard, 1940, and then he gets the log, it's 1941. We're coming up on America's involvement in World War II. How did that affect Les Paul?
Well, Les got it in his head after a few years in New York that he wanted to move to the West Coast. He wanted to work with people like Bing Crosby. He just really loved Bing and wanted to work with Bing. He didn't know him. He figured he would just pull the same kind of trick that he pulled to get in with Fred Waring. He figured he would just show up, and of course Bing would see how great he was and want to work with him, which is largely what happened. So he shows up in Los Angeles. The war is in effect. He gets drafted. But really, Army life wasn't too much different for Les than his non-military life was, because he had a job playing in various Army bands, and he would end up playing backup for people like Dinah Shore who were entertaining the troops. So really, it wasn't all that different being in the military. But once he got out, he was ready to really rev his career up into full gear. And he did end up making a couple of recordings with a new trio that he put together before he started playing with people like Bing. And I wanted to play one of the clips from that era where he released a couple of really, really nice songs. They didn't become huge hits, but with a trio there, and they really showed his maturing style. It showed the sound of the guitar getting more pure and his jazz chops really improving. And I thought maybe we could listen to Blue Skies.
Pretty amazing virtuoso type playing, isn't
yeah
it?
His fingers were really flying on that one and on those other songs he recorded during that period. At that time he was working as a staff musician at NBC Radio, so that was where he really got to connect with a lot of the biggest names of that time. And that was where he finally did manage to connect with Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters, and he would back those people up regularly. He also at that time was putting together his own recording studio in his garage and experimenting with a lot of new recording techniques that the other sound engineers just hadn't figured out yet. And he was developing a lot of effects for the first time. Things like echo and delay hadn't been invented yet, and he was going to introduce those a few years later when he started playing with Mary Ford. But before that happened, in 1945, he released a song with Bing Crosby that became a huge hit, and this is probably the song that really introduced him to a nationwide audience for the first time. And it wasn't just Les backing up Bing. It was truly a collaboration between the two. This is a 1945 record called It's Been a Long, Long Time.
Kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since I can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams I dreamed about you, or just how empty they all seemed without you. So kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since I can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams I dreamed about you, or just how empty they all seemed without you. So kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
Bing Crosby and guitarist Les Paul. It's been a long, long time from 1945, and it won't be such a long time before we return with more about Les Paul on University of the Air here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Les Paul with the Andrews Sisters and the 1946 hit Rumors Are Flying. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Bob Jacobson, who has a biography out on Les Paul, the great guitar innovator and, I think you could say, virtuoso too, mover and shaker in the music business. And we've followed his career from the 30s into the mid-1940s, where, well, you could say this is the peak of his career in terms not just of performing but inventing, couldn't you, Bob?
He was definitely achieving a lot of his technological breakthroughs at this time, although some of his biggest musical hits in terms of sales were still to come in the 1950s. But it was a really fruitful period for him in his studio. He was coming up with all sorts of innovations in terms of recording techniques, guitar effects, and most importantly, this is when he was making huge breakthroughs in one of his most significant innovations, multi-track recording, which we all take for granted now. Mm-hmm. But back then, the idea that you could have the same person play one part and then go back and layer another part over it was unthinkable. Nobody knew how to do it yet. And so Les was experimenting a lot with that, and his initial way of doing it was what we now call ping pong recording, which basically involves two recording machines. You record one part, and then you play that back while you play another part and record both of those on a second machine.
With some little loss of then audio quality a little bit, there.
Then you go back and record a third part on the first machine and back and forth for as many as you can stand with the loss of quality you get from all that bouncing back and forth. But people continued to do that technique for many more years. I think the Beatles even did some of that years later. But after finally perfecting that technique, Les released a song in 1947 called Lover, which introduced multi-track recording to the world. And I'll tell you, for the life of me, it blows my mind that this was a hit, because I think it sounds like outer space music. It's, I mean, I love it, but it's just really crazy sounding, and I'm amazed that people were ready to hear this kind of thing.
And before we hear it, can you tell us what is it that we're going to be hearing on it that shows that multi-tracking?
Yeah, you're going to be hearing a whole lot of different guitar parts played simultaneously, but they were all Les. He just recorded, he layered them one after the other, bouncing back and forth on different recording machines.
Do you know, was it promoted that way? Could the novelty have been part of the appeal?
Well, I think they did market it very well. It was called The New Sound. That was what it was introduced as. This is The New Sound, as to distinguish itself from all the other new sounds out there. But yeah, they called it The New Sound, and they did market it well, and this became a pretty big hit.
The Lover from 94. Now, that's so frenetic sounding, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Now, interestingly, the little wedding theme at the end, presages something that happened just a couple of years later. Right around the time of Lover, he met Mary Ford. Her name actually was Colleen Summers. And she changed her name to Mary Ford because Les had this idea of doing a radio show that had more of kind of a down-home, country-ish kind of theme. And Mary was a singer, and so they decided Colleen Summers, for some reason, wasn't down-home enough.
If so her name had been Mary Ford, Mary she Ford. Would have changed it to Colleen Summers.
I think so.
Really good name. Yeah. And we started the hour with an excerpt from one of those shows from 1950. I think, was it just called The Les Paul Show?
Les Paul and Mary Ford.
Okay, give them equal billing there. Yeah. One of the things, other than the playing, that certainly is spectacular, the playing of Les Paul's, how low-key it was. I mean, this is a time still when radio shows were scripted, but, and I don't know if this one was or not, you can't tell. That's what's impressive, at least when Les Paul and Mary Ford are talking. It sounds unscripted. It sounds spontaneous.
Yeah, they really did have a way with that casual banter, and I think that was one of the hallmarks of the success of their radio show and then later their TV show that they had together.
Now, there's a difference between a radio show and a TV show, I think, in that a lot easier to do the electronic trickery in radio than it would be in television, right?
I'm sure that's true, although they weren't above doing electronic trickery on TV. During the period in the early 50s when Les and Mary had a number of really well-performing hits together. They would appear on TV shows, Ed Sullivan Show, places like that during the 50s and the early heyday of television.
Live television.
And, you know, it was an obvious problem they had to solve. How do you go about performing these songs on live TV that you had done using multi-track recording in the studio that hadn't ever been a problem before? So Les came up with an idea he called the Les Pulverizer. And it was allegedly this black box that he would have on the stage with him. And he would talk about the Les Pulverizer and how he was going to use that to multiply the sound on the fly. And, of course, it was pretty much just a big fraud. All he was doing was using his little box to trigger an offstage recording device that had pre-recorded the other parts while he played live one of the parts.
Yeah. One thing we skipped over was his electrocution. And we're also hitting up on a car accident.
Yeah.
Can you tell some of the challenges to keeping Les Paul alive?
Yeah, you know, one of the amazing things about Les's whole life story and the whole arc of his biography is that he continually had to overcome these immense challenges, and some of those challenges were self-inflicted. For example, back when he was in New York, right before he moved to the West Coast, he was fiddling with one of his early amplifiers. And it's kind of amazing this didn't happen sooner than this, but he suffered a very serious electrical shock and burned up some arm and chest muscles, and his hands were very badly injured, and he couldn't play the guitar at all for several months. And I think it was that period when he couldn't play and he was just lying around that he kind of got the idea of what the rest of his career was going to look like and what he would try to accomplish, because he didn't have the pressure of having to show up and perform somewhere every night for a period of time. And then right before Lover was released, Les and Mary were in a very bad car accident. They were driving home from visiting Les's mother in Waukesha, and they were down in, I think, Oklahoma, and suddenly out of nowhere, a big snowstorm hits in Oklahoma, which I guess is pretty rare, and they drive off the road, off a bridge into a ravine, and Mary was not injured severely, but Les was very badly injured. He nearly died, and he smashed his right elbow, so badly that initially the doctors thought they were going to have to amputate. And Les convinced them to set his arm at just the right angle, so his finger was at about belly button, or his hand was at about belly button level, so he'd still be able to pick the guitar with his right arm. And so that's what they did, and he did recover. And there are some interesting photos of him actually playing the guitar while half his body is in a cast, but sure enough, his hand is in just the right spot, so he can still pick.
Unstoppable.
Yeah.
Now, did he and Mary then produce records, and if so, how successful were they?
Well, the early 50s were really the peak years for Les Paul's career as a recording artist in terms of sales. He and Mary put out a series of records that sold very, very well. They got married along the way in 1949, and they were constantly on radio, and they recorded their first really, really big hit together in 1951, and that was How High the Moon. And it's really interesting because in this song you hear several layers of Mary's voice, and it's just interesting to contrast that with the Andrews Sisters cut that we heard a bit earlier, because all the sisters had to be singing their parts spot on at the same time because they recorded that in one sitting, whereas Mary had the luxury of multi-track recording, so she was able to do multiple takes and layer upon layer until she got it just right. And it really shows in the precision of her singing on How High the Moon from 1951.
The Moon, 1951, with many versions of Mary Ford layered on herself with
right.
Les Paul. What would the label be on that kind of music? I mean, is it pop? Is it country? Is it? It sounds like many different things fused together.
Yeah, boy, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, I would tend to think of it as pop music, but I don't think that label was really applied back then. I don't know. That's a real good question. I mean, they thought of themselves as kind of a little bit country. But it was also obvious that that was during the era of proto-rock. Now, whether they would have used the word rock, I have no idea. Probably not.
Not yet.
But you definitely start hearing elements of, you know, rockabilly and things like that that would evolve in all those different branches over the next decade or so,
well,
during the 50s.
That whole question of music marketing is an interesting one because, I mean, you can look at the Billboard, you know, top 10, top 20 as late as the early 60s and as a real hodgepodge of, you know, what we call country, folk, rock, novelty. And so if you go back this far into the early 50s, the marketing is just everything is kind of lumped in there together to a great extent.
Right. Yeah. They hadn't really done all that segmentation
right.
yet by that point. And obviously all of those labels are solely about marketing and have very little to do with the actual music, because music has, you know, all these subtle gradations
yeah.
that blend from one style into the next and borrow from each other.
What are some of the techniques we heard in there? I mean, it sounded like reverb, you know, echoey.
Yeah, there was definitely some echo and delay effects being used in there, which Les was a pioneer in the use of. And obviously, he was getting better at the multi-tracking. One thing that had happened over the previous couple of years is that Les had figured out how to do multi-track recording using one machine. He originally used it was an Ampex reel-to-reel recorder that had been a gift from Bing Crosby. And Les figured out that by putting additional recording heads on it, by installing them himself, he could do all that recording on a single hunk of tape on parallel tracks, like was done for the next several decades to come after that. And that obviously prevented that loss of quality that you get when you're ping-ponging back and forth onto different machines. So that's one of the reasons why the sound had improved so much by then from his first experiments in the 40s.
Was his biggest hit with Mary, was it Vaya con Dios?
It was, yeah. That came 2 years later in 1953, and the biggest hit that Les and Mary had together was Vaya con Dios.
What do you think made it such a big hit?
It's a very catchy melody. It's got that kind of sappy sentimentality that a lot of people seem to like.
Vaya con Dios.
Now the hacienda's dark, the town is sleeping. Now the time has come to part, the time for weeping. Vaya con Dios, my darling. Vaya con Dios, my love. Now the village mission bells are softly ringing. If you listen with your heart, you'll hear them singing. Vaya con Dios, my darling. Vaya con Dios, my love. Wherever you may be, I'll be beside you. Although your many million dreams away, each night I'll say a prayer to guide you, to hasten every lonely hour of every lonely day. Now the dawn is breaking through a great tomorrow, but the memories we share are there to borrow. Vaya con Dios, my darling. Vaya con Dios, my
biggest hit for the combination of Les Paul and his wife Mary Ford, Vaya con Dios, from 1953. And we'll look at the last part of the career, still a lot of it left, of Les Paul when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
He's the man who started everything. He's just a genius. That's the comment of Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page about Les Paul. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, back with our guest, Bob Jacobson, who has written a biography called Les Paul, Guitar Wizard, tracing the career of Waukesha wizard Les Paul, guitar player and musical innovator. We ended with a song that you said was the greatest hit by Les Paul and his wife, Mary Ford, but the two of them wouldn't stay together much longer after that, right?
Well, their popularity started kind of waning over the next several years. They continued recording into the early 60s, but they never had any hits quite as big as that one. Other kinds of music, rock and roll, started becoming more popular, and their kind of music was seen as, I think, a little too old-timey for some listeners, perhaps. And so by 1964, or even a couple years earlier than that, Mary had kind of gotten tired of touring. They had a family by then, and under the stress of all of that touring and everything, their marriage had come under some strain. And so they split up in 1964, and by then Les was also starting to suffer from some signs of aging. His fingers were not as nimble as they once were, and his hearing had begun to deteriorate just from all of that sound he had been chasing all those years. He liked to call it chasing sound when he would mess around in the studio, and that's where the name of that public television special about him came from. So he basically retired in 1965 and just spent his time puttering around in the studio, not doing too much. But then something interesting happened. By the late 60s, all these young rockers started getting interested in the electric guitar, and people started figuring out that it was Les Paul who had been behind all of this important inventing that made their craft possible. So especially these, you know, young English blues-oriented guys like Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin, like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, they all revered Les Paul. And over time, people started kind of clamoring for a comeback. And in the early 70s, he started making occasional appearances. And then in 1975, he did this big comeback show at Carnegie Hall. He kind of had living legend status by then, and it was a big to-do. And around that time, he gets a call from an old friend, Chet Atkins, the younger brother of his old trio mate, Jimmy Atkins, who used to be the singer in one of his early trios. And Chet says, "Les, let's make a record together." So they go into the studio and they make a record called Chester and Lester. And it's a huge sensation, wins all these Grammy Awards. And once again, Les Paul is a legend again, and all this new appreciation among young rockers who probably had never heard of him before and wondered who that guy whose name on all those guitars in the guitar shop, who the heck that was. It was this Les Paul. And now they know, and they get to hear him playing with Chet Atkins, and I thought we'd listen to a cut from that album, Caravan, from 1976 album Chester and Lester. Thank you.
Is that how it ends? Does it fade out in the way they did it?
Well, however you just heard it.
that was the whole thing.
But a little different than the Duke Ellington version, wouldn't you say?
a little bit, but boy, it's a lot of fun. It's very engaging. There was, you know, so much, as we were listening to it, so much of it that made us think, oh, that kind of reminds me of some rock, you know, here and there. Was Les Paul, influential as he was among rockers, was he not interested in playing rock himself?
Well, he got interested as the years went by. I mean, he was never, you know, going to be a rocker, you know, with the hair and everything. But he enjoyed that rock musicians cared about his music and were influenced by music. And he loved interacting with those guys. He was Steve Miller's guitar teacher. He was pals with Steve Miller's father, and he gave Steve Miller his early guitar lessons. And, you know, he loved it when... you know, not a few years later, in the late 80s when he started doing not even the late 80s, in the mid 80s when he started doing a weekly show in New York at a club called Fat Tuesdays. And rock stars would always show up to jam with him and sit in. And it was a real festive kind of atmosphere. And he kept doing that weekly show first at Fat Tuesdays. And then after they closed, he moved it over to a club called Iridium. And he kept doing that until not too long at all before he died.
And he would live another, 30-some years after the recording we just heard of Caravan.
Yeah.
He must have been proud to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and some of the other awards that he had coming his way.
Yeah, by the time he was in his 80s, the honors and accolades started kind of flooding in at a pretty rapid clip. He was in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He got a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award, the Grammy Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the National Inventors Hall of Fame, kind of one after another. If there's a Hall of Fame having to do with music, odds are that he's in it.
I think we're going to go out on a song that he recorded when he was in his 90s. So before we do that, let me thank our guest, Bob Jacobson, and point out that I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. And we are going to hear what exactly?
This is a song called 69 Freedom Special from a 2005 album that Les recorded with a whole bunch of other famous musicians. It's called Les Paul and Friends. And you have never heard a 90-year-old white guy play this funky in your life.
Les Paul.